to the Stem Cell Report. I'm Martin Pera, the editor-in-chief of Stem Cell Reports, the open access journal of the International Society for Stem Cell Research. In this monthly podcast, we look at highlights from the latest advances in stem cell research appearing in the journals. We'll be speaking to authors to explore the questions that led to new breakthroughs and learn how they tackled those questions. We'll hear about the background to novel findings, the challenges ahead, and we'll get to know a little bit about the personalities behind the work. Thanks for listening in. Over the 10-year history of Stem Cell Reports, the journal has published nearly 2,000 papers across the breadth of the field. In this special episode of the Stem Cell Report, we're celebrating the anniversary of the journal by talking with authors from some of the most highly cited publications in the journal's 10-year history, a sort of greatest hits podcast. Skeletal muscle, which accounts for 40% of the body mass, can be regenerated in response to injury or disease due to the presence of muscle stem cells, also known as satellite cells. These cells are normally quiescent, but they can become proliferative to maintain homeostasis and for muscle repair in response to damage. However, in aging and in some pathological conditions, the function of the progenitors becomes compromised, inhibiting the efficient regeneration of myofibers, leading to muscle loss. Research in muscle stem cell biology, including studies of the developmental origins, cell fate determination, niche, and heterogeneity of these progenitors, has not only provided valuable insight into the physiology of muscle growth and aging, but has also shed light on the mechanisms underlying muscle wasting diseases and potential approaches to treating them. One such neuromuscular disease is Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a monogenic disorder that afflicts approximately 1 out of 5,000 males born worldwide. My guests today are truly a dream team of experts on muscle stem cell biology and its applications to treat disease. I'm joined by Akitsu Hata, a principal investigator and associate professor in the Department of Clinical Application at the Center for iPS Cell Research and Application of Kyoto University. Akitsu was the recipient of the 2020 Japanese Society for Regenerative Medicine Award. His laboratory published a 2015 paper, Precise Correction of the Dystrophin Gene in Duchenne Muscular Dystrophy Patient-Induced Pluripotent Stem Cells by Talon and CRISPR-Cas9. Also joining the program is Tom Rendo, who is the director of the Eli and Edith Broad Center of Regenerative Medicine and Stem Cell Research at the University of California, Los Angeles, where he's also a professor of neurology and of molecular cell and developmental biology. Dr. Rendo is a board-certified neurologist, a member of the National Academy of Medicine, and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is also the 2023 recipient of the ISSCR Achievement Award, which recognizes the transformative body of work of an investigator that has had a major impact on the field of stem cell research or regenerative medicine. His laboratory published the 2015 paper entitled Ex Vivo Expansion and In Vivo Self-Renewal of Human Muscle Stem Cells. And finally, April Pyle is an associate professor in the Department of Microbiology, Immunology, and Molecular Genetics at UCLA, and a member of the Eli and Edith Broad Stem Cell Center, the Center for Duchenne Muscular Dystrophy, and the Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center there. We're also very lucky that April serves as an associate editor of Stem Cell Reports. Welcome to you all, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Martin.
Thanks for having us.
Great.
Tom, this program began as a retrospective on the journal's 10-year history and the work published on muscle and muscle stem cells. Your research centered largely on aging. So what makes muscle a particularly interesting tissue to study from this standpoint?
So muscle is interesting from an aging point of view, really from two general perspectives. And the first is what I would say is a kind of a tissue-specific change, and that is sarcopenia, the loss of muscle bulk with age. And it's a profound, has a profound impact on society. It affects virtually everyone as they get older. And it has a huge impact on a person's kind of health and well-being. On the other hand, another thing that happens with muscle with aging is more of a shared phenotype. And that is a decline in the ability of muscle to repair itself. And we see that kind of age-related change in virtually all tissues in the body that are mediated by stem cell homeostasis and repair. And the latter, this kind of declining regenerative potential, is something that we study in particular with regard to muscle stem cells. But we have an interest in whether there might be, in fact, a role of stem cells in maintenance in a way that might actually have a therapeutic application in sarcopenia. I think something that's not clear yet, but is certainly promising.
Great, thanks. So April, you started your graduate career studying aneuploidy during spermatogenesis. So how did your interest in muscle stem cells and regeneration evolve?
Great question. Yeah, so I did my PhD work with fantastic mentor, Marianne Handel. And through that time, I was very interested also in stem cells. And so when I did my postdoc, I looked for stem cell labs. And actually, there are very few doing human pluripotent stem cells at the time. I joined Peter Donovan's lab, who actually studied both primordial germ cells and basic properties of pluripotency. And interestingly in that, I got a postdoctoral fellowship to study specification of pluripotent stem cells to mesoderm. And we were really interested in cardiomyocytes at the time. And then in my own lab, I actually switched gears to think about specification of human pluripotent stem cells into another mesoderm derivative in praxial mesoderm. And this actually is very understudied. And so this was sort of wide open, and I began to dig in and still thinking about questions of how to specify pluripotent stem cells into skeletal muscle.
Great to hear you started out with Marianne. I didn't know that.
She's still
a huge presence up here.
She's an amazing mentor.
Continues to be.
Yep.
Kitsu, from what I've read on the web, you actually derived transgenic chickens during your PhD as you were focused on retroviral transgenic methodology. Tell us about your journey from transgenic chickens to editing iPS cells to treat muscular dystrophy.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a very pleasant journey. So my career started with genetic engineering. So I started working on a lentiviral vector to transduce like a human therapeutic antibody into chicken embryos. We were successfully able to transduce a gene that could be inserted, but we faced a problem of gene silencing, so that we had a very hard time achieving the good expression in chicken embryo. So I was fascinated with that phenomenon, and I'd like to study more about the molecular aspect of genetic silencing. So I decided to move on to the mouse embryonic stem cell to study more about gene regulation aspect. So I joined as a postdoctoral research fellow at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto under Dr. James Ellis' lab. So I started working on mouse embryonic stem cells as well as human embryonic stem cells. And then on that time, in 2006, Shinya Yamanaka discovered a way of reprogramming skin cell to the pluripotent stem cell, so-called iPS cell. So I was so fascinated, and I also started working on iPS cell. Then after that, since I would like to continue more about iPS research, I joined in Shinya's research institute at Kyoto University. And then on that time, I decided to work on, I'd like to use my genetic engineering ability to do something for patients. So I decided to work on Duchenne muscular dystrophy to correct genetic mutation.
Terrific. Well, wonderful. You were able to return to Japan at CIRA, right?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Tom, there are two main topics we're talking about today. The first is muscle and the role of stem cells. Can you give our listeners a brief primer about the role of stem cells in muscle development, homeostasis, and disease, please?
How much time do you have? big topic. So let's see. So in development, there are muscle progenitors, that are proliferating in the body during development that are responsible for the formation of muscle. And muscle is an interesting tissue, of course, because it's one of the few true syncytia in the body. So that is one cytoplasm and many, many, many nuclei. So these progenitors during development mostly fuse with one another to form these multinucleated cells we call muscle fibers that are responsible for movement, of course, and also is important endocrine organ. And so that's how muscle forms. And during development, some of these progenitors actually break off and become quiescent stem cells. So they form both the differentiated muscle and then the future stem cells that remain quiescent in the muscle until they're called upon to repair the tissue. And then in terms of, let me say for disease, and April will obviously talk more about this. These are the cells that are responsible in degenerative diseases for the regenerative response in response to degeneration. So in the dystrophies, for example, there's ongoing muscle fiber degeneration, and the stem cells that are present in the tissue are the ones that are responsible for activating, proliferating, and trying to repair, ultimately failing to keep up with the degeneration. So they're important, and maybe we'll get into this, as potential therapeutic approaches to muscular dystrophy. I'm sure we'll get into this. In terms of homeostasis, as I mentioned earlier, the kind of keeping muscle, just kind of the muscle bulk normal over time in the absence of injury, in the absence of disease, in some ways, the jury is still out as to the critical role of muscle stem cells in homeostasis, unlike stem cells in tissues like skin or gut or blood, where they're absolutely responsible for homeostatic turnover. Muscle is mostly a static tissue. There's not a lot of turnover, and yet there are stem cells present, and it's unclear to what extent, in what species and in what muscles, the stem cells are critically important for homeostasis. Again, I think it's an important topic, but it's not nearly as clear as the role of stem cells in development or disease.
Terrific. Thank you. I hope the medical students at UCLA are lucky enough to hear you lecture.
Thank you.
April, the other thing we're talking about today is muscle disease, specifically Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And for the listeners who might not know so much about this disease, can you kind of tell us a bit about it? Who does it affect? What's the typical course, clinical course? And what do we know about its cause? And also, you know, where are we with efforts to model this disorder in a dish?
Yeah. So Duchenne muscular dystrophy is a devastating neuromuscular wasting disease, and it affects primarily boys. It's X-linked, and it is about 1 in 5,000 boys. And so the course of disease progression is really the usually diagnosis is around age 3, as there's delays in motor skills, walking, and then it sort of takes a course from there of like continuous bouts of injury, which then activates the stem cell to repair. And this is sort of a continuous battle, because dystrophin, which is the mutation in DMD, is leading to mutation dystrophin leads to DMD. And essentially, this is the muscle stabilizer protein. And so when this protein is missing, this, you know, leads to many rounds of needs to repair the muscle. And so early in there, I would say by age 10, you see that the muscle and the stem cells themselves also get replaced with fibrotic tissue. This is a challenge. This leads to wheelchair dependency in the teens, and usually death in the early 20s. There is no cure. And so there's been a lot of efforts, as you can imagine, to try and develop therapeutics for DMD and to really model this in a dish. And so there's been a lot of efforts by many across the world to develop DMD iPSCs and to differentiate them into the affected cell types, which is namely cardiomyocytes and skeletal muscle, and then to look for therapeutics as well as, genotype to phenotype effects in these patient models. And so there's been a lot of progress in the field looking at small molecules as well as potential gene targeting and therapeutics that we'll get into today.
Terrific. So on that topic, Akitsu, this brings us to your paper that looked at genetically correcting the problem in the Duchenne gene. So this dystrophin gene is huge, with 79 exons. And, it was recognized a long time ago that any approach to try to replace the full gene would be very challenging. So your paper tested correcting the genetic defect using TALEN and CRISPR-Cas9, which were sort of competing approaches at the time. What exactly did you find?
Sure. So those genetic engineering technologies, so more precisely TALEN and CRISPR-Cas9, so that was, again, on that time, it was the emerging technologies to correct the human genetic sequences at the desired site. So we wonder whether those tools could be utilized to specifically target the mutated dystrophin region. And we tested the way how we could best repair the mutated dystrophin gene. So what we tried is that the so genetic mutation causes a loss of protein expression, so that the we try to restore the protein expression by actually deleting some of the particular targeted exon, so that we could reframe the protein reading frame, so that the dystrophin protein could be expressed. So we experimented those ideas on patient-derived iPSL, and then we were able to confirm that the restored dystrophin protein could be expressed after skeletal muscle differentiation. So it was really exciting, and I was so delighted to see that those genetic tools can actually correct patient mutation on a dish.
Great. April, you're trying a different approach to correcting the genetic defect and potentially treating this disease. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's a very similar approach. We were at the time also just trying CRISPR, which was, you know, really hadn't been used that much in iPSC-derived correction strategies. So we wanted to think about an approach that would target the most patients possible. And so we looked at previous literature, a lot of labs who have really shown that there's an allelic disease called Becker muscular dystrophy, where the patients may not even know they're dystrophic, and they come into the clinic in their 60s with maybe cardiac issues or some delays at that point. And so we wanted to see, could we actually take a Duchenne protein and make it into a Becker protein, which theoretically could help us extend the life span of these patients, even towards their 60s. So it's not a full correction, but it's actually generating a truncated protein, albeit is really well known in the clinic to be a functional protein. And so for this, we used a CRISPR strategy to cut out a hotspot mutation of patients with Duchenne have mutations within a certain exon region. And so we said, let's just cut out this entire region and then see with CRISPR if we could get rejoining events that would actually lead to production of a functional, albeit truncated protein. And so with this, that's what we did. We found a set of guides that cut in the introns around this hotspot region. We were able to see rejoining in both cardiomyocytes and skeletal muscle. And we were also able to take these cells that had been corrected with a restored dystrophin and show that they could engraft in vivo and restore dystrophin in a mouse model of DMD. And so, yeah, we're very excited about moving this platform forward and think it has a lot of promise in this context.
Terrific. So where are you now? Are you headed for clinical trial yet? Or?
Well, we are still working on delivery strategies. And so we're thinking about the best way to deliver this platform in vivo. And so the two strategies would be direct delivery of the CRISPR machinery using probably an AAV-based strategy. Alternatively, you could do an ex vivo correction of stem cells and then move this in. And so there's challenges with both, but we're comparing both avenues.
Great. So, Tom, we're going to get on to therapy again in a minute, but I'll take you back to the cell biology. Your lab's done some great work on the role of mesenchymal progenitor cells in the regulation of muscle maintenance and regeneration. I think it's fair to say there's a certain degree of imprecision in some of the literature concerning mesenchymal progenitor cells. And so what do we know about the function of these cells in normal physiology and disease states in muscles? Are there properties similar to mesenchymal progenitors from other tissues, or as I suspect, do they have a unique tissue-specific signature and function?
So, you know, that's an important topic and a challenging question, and you're absolutely right about the imprecision. I mean, the term mesenchymal progenitor or mesenchymal stem cell is used quite loosely and means very different things to different people. We have studied this a population in muscle, which has been given the name fibroadipogenic progenitor, or FAP, or FAPs. And these actually, you know, these are mesenchymal progenitors. They're mesenchymal tissue, and they're single cells, but they're relatively well-defined molecularly. And that's, I think that's important. And And yet they're still quite heterogeneous. So it's like fibroblasts, or, you know, they're names that are used for cells that are quite generic. And then when you start digging down, there are many types and there are many flavors. In muscle, these FAPs, like I said, they have a quite a specific molecular signature. So we can identify them, we can study them. And most notably, we and others, but we have eliminated these cells from muscle and seen the impact of deleting muscle of these cells. And it's really quite profound in two ways. So if we deplete the muscle of FAPs and then injure the muscle, the regeneration of the muscle is markedly impaired. So even though these are not cells that make muscle, they support the regenerative response in a profound way. And that has been shown by other investigators along the way using other techniques as well. One of the things that we showed is when we depleted FAPs from muscle, either globally, which is challenging, or focally within one muscle, it had a profound effect on homeostasis, as if these cells within the muscle are maintaining the muscle fibers. And when we deplete them, we get quite rapid atrophy of the muscle. So that was really interesting. And so they're clearly this very important supportive role, both for regeneration and homeostasis. One other point I'll make is that this molecular signature, and I'll just, you know, for the details, it's PDGF receptor alpha positive cells. They're found in tissues throughout the body, these same kinds of cells. Now, are they the same? Are they different? I think what happens is these cells get educated by the tissue they live in. And so they are different, but they're different because they're instructed by the environment they're in. And so the mesenchymal progenitors in muscle behave differently than mesenchymal progenitors in lung, et cetera. But I think, again, there's a lot of overlap in terms of what the real origins of these cells are and probably what they're doing in the tissues.
I think the more we see rigorous approaches like genetics applied to these cells, the more we'll learn about them.
Couldn't agree more.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll continue our discussion.
Stem Cell Reports is ISSCR's open access peer-reviewed society journal for scientists by scientists. The journal publishes research and commentaries that drive the field of stem cell science forward.
Welcome back to the Stem Cell Report. We've been talking with Akit Suhata, April Pyle, and Tom Rando about their research on muscle stem cells, and the treatment of muscular disorders. Akitsu, you're at CSIRA, one of the foremost centers of iPS cell research. So from your perspective there, what are some of the most promising emerging technologies for the delivery of gene therapy?
Sure. I think that's a very interesting question. So in our institute, we've been working on a couple of gene delivery technologies, as April mentioned. So some of the researchers working on AAV viral vectors, retroviral lentiviral vectors, adenoviral vectors, also more physical approach such as electroporation or liposuction. I think each technology has pros and cons. So I think the best answer would be you should use the according to the situation and the target cell population or in vivo versus ex vivo. So one of the most exciting technology, I think, in my view, is that the it's a rapid nanoparticle technology, which it also utilized for vaccine for COVID-19. So it's a fully chemically defined system, but it can generate less than 100 nanometer of nanoparticles, and which are relatively very stable, and also which can target the cell with high efficiency with less toxicity. So this mRNA, messenger RNA-based delivery system is, I think, a very promising approach. And there's still a room to be improved more, but I would see more potential to be used in a gene therapy field.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of excitement around that. Tom and April, we've been talking about stem cell-based gene therapy for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. But how do you see it working in practice? That is it likely that, as with other disorders, correction of a defect ex vivo followed by cell transplantation might emerge as the most promising route in future? Tom, I'll let you go first, and then we'll hear from April.
So April is the expert. this is a topic that has been near and dear to my heart since I started my lab. I started my lab working on muscular dystrophy. So this is something I'm very, very interested in, very, very dedicated to. I mean, the challenge for cell therapy, whether by, genetically corrected or, other ways of delivering muscle cells to tissues for therapy is, it's delivery. How do you get cells to muscle distributed throughout the body, including the diaphragm, maybe including the heart? So, delivery has been and continues to be just such a challenge for cellular therapy for muscle diseases. And I think, there has been a foray into looking at cells that might circulate in the blood and then extravasate from the blood into tissue, so-called mesangioblasts, and that, that's been an interesting approach, but that has been the real challenge, is how do you do this systemically? It's hard to imagine giving thousands of injections locally to get all the muscles. So that's a big challenge. And then, the kind of work that April does, I think, addresses this issue, but we've always faced the issue of the potency of the cells we're delivering, because if we grow the cells up in culture, like we take satellite cells, muscle stem cells, we put them in culture, we grow them up, they lose their potency almost immediately and dramatically. So, we have kind of focused in my lab about the biology of quiescence, the biology of potency. And I'm just going to make one segue. And one of the things that we've done is to move away from stem cell therapy for muscle dystrophy to stem cell therapy for muscle trauma. Now, why is that interesting? It's because at least we're putting muscle into a tissue that itself is not degenerating. So maybe what we learn from treating traumatic injuries where there's a piece of muscle missing, basically in vivo tissue engineering, maybe what we learn about delivery, engraftment, myogenesis in that model will be applicable, we hope, to what we envision as a future of stem cell therapy for muscular dystrophies. But I'll turn it over to April, because again, this is kind of what she does.
No, I've followed what you've done to be where I am. So, I think you hit all the points. I mean, I'll just reiterate, the challenges, is essentially thinking about how do you make a good, especially from pluripotent stem cells, how do you make a good stem cell in a dish? And then if you make it, as Tom mentioned, how do you support it to get enough that you can have enough cells for engraftment? And then those are two challenges before you get them to transplantation studies. And then there you have to think about not only how many muscles can I get, but what is the environment I'm putting them into? So we think a lot about the dystrophic environment is highly fibrotic. And so, some of the work that Tom's doing, thinking about that might help in terms of combination approaches. So I think you might even need combination strategies when you're thinking about a stem cell delivery mechanism. And then the third, I think could be interesting, is a combination of an AAV-based strategy and a stem cell-based strategy, because currently most AAVs do not target the stem cells. And if they do, they do so inefficiently. And they also, it's not clear how functional those stem cells are long-term with the need to really, repopulate after injury. And so potentially you could, use some sort of combination strategy. So that's where I see the field sort of moving in that direction. But the holy grail would be systemic-based delivery strategies. And I think for this, you're going to have to engineer the cells you make to enable them to do this somehow. This is not what they're naturally born to do. And so a combination of an engineering strategy with a stem cell you make from pluripotent stem cells to help them learn, if possible, to do this, I think is cutting edge and will be a future avenue, but we're not there yet.
Those are some great thoughts. I think your point about the pathological environment is so critical to all of these stem cell-based therapies. What happens to cells when you put them there, and what's their fate and what's their function? We really don't know much about that. Tom, I've got to mention that you are the recipient of this year's ISSCR Achievement Award, which recognizes a fantastic body of work in your career. So my congratulations on that achievement. It's really wonderful. But another major achievement was your recent appointment to the role of the director at the Broad Center at UCLA, which is, of course, a great stem cell institute with some outstanding faculty like Dr. Pyle here. So I'm just wondering, what you hope to accomplish in that role. And from a personal point of view, how is the adjustment in lifestyle moving from the Bay Area to LA? I spent some time in Los Angeles and I loved it, but it's very different to Northern California.
Okay, well, I'll start with that first. No, I mean, LA is fantastic. It's this, you know, highly diverse mega city. And it's, like you say, it couldn't be more different than the Bay Area in so many ways. But, you know, it's a place of growth and opportunity. And UCLA is kind of at the hub of that in terms of academic excellence and rigor. And, you know, I was very fortunate to be able to move here and to direct the center. So, yeah, the challenge is really a fewfold. So on the one hand, we always want to and will be continuing to expand the basic biology of stem cells. And a lot of what the three of us have all done here have come from very, very basic research that has become translational. So, you know, that'll be with all the emphasis on translation, both from the NIH and from the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, which, you know, we firmly believe in, of course. At the same time, we will invest in basic stem cell biology and recruiting basic stem cell biologists to expand the faculty in that area. At the same time, the real output is how many programs can we get in going from the bench to the bedside? How many actual stem cell therapies can we have in the clinic or at least in the pipeline? We have, you know, really great translational programs here at UCLA, from stem cell and gene therapies for hematologic diseases of children, diseases of the retina, diseases, neurodegenerative diseases. So they're all in the pipeline. And I think, you know, 5 years from now, I'll look back on at least this first stint and ask how many more translational and clinical programs do we have that we've been able to take from the laboratories here at UCLA into the clinic. And of course, we depend heavily on the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine to support those. And that's the real focus. I'll just mention the other aspect that I'd love to build here, which we talked about initially, is again, kind of getting at stem cell aging, because I think the biology of stem cells as they age is going to be hugely important, both endogenous stem cells and potentially transplanted stem cells in a lot of these age-related diseases, which are the most, you know, the biggest, baddest, most intractable diseases that we face.
Well, that's a great agenda. And can I say the three of you are excellent examples of people who've come from basic research to wind up in a translational arena. And, you know, you've talked about some huge challenges for this field, but think back to 1998 when human pluripotent stem cells were first described, and come some way since then. So I'm optimistic. April, we'll finish up with you. As you know, as an editor of Stem Cell Reports, the journal is celebrating its 10-year anniversary. Hope you'll be in Boston to help us with that. Over the past 10 years, the journal has established itself as a leader in the stem cell field and certainly publishes high-quality manuscripts like the ones we've been talking about today. So looking forward, what would you like to see for the journal of the next 10 years? And you're not allowed to mention firing the current editor-in-chief.
Actually, I think one of the most exciting things that I've seen and that I think really is a part of ISSCR, which is linked to Stem Cell Reports, is education. And I think, you know, communicating not just to the stem cell community, but also to the public and readers that want to learn, you know, the truth about stem cells. And I appreciate this so much, that the role that this journal, the journal does, and also ISSCR in this effort. And I think, you know, that's going to continue to be intertwined in the journal. And I think some of the most highly cited papers are from you on these topics, Martin. And so I think that will continue to evolve and play such a critical role, in addition to the basic biology, which I think is really strong and will continue to be strong. I would like to also see, as we're developing these basic ideas into translation, that even those sort of protocols or approaches, you know, are widely shared with the community, so that we can learn from each other, especially as there's going to be in the next 10 years, I have no doubt, an explosion in cell-based therapies from pluripotent stem cells. I think this will also be an important component of the journal. And I think this will lead to a lot of groundbreaking papers that are continue to be published in Stem Cell Reports. And I'm looking forward to being a part of as much as I can and seeing the journey.
Terrific. Well, that's a great thought about sort of open source translational protocols. And I think, you know, that will be very important for the field going forward so that we all understand what we're doing and what the challenges are. So that's all we have time for today. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to our guests for sharing their stories with us. This has been the Stem Cell Report. Thank you for listening.
The International Society for Stem Cell Research is a global scientific society that promotes excellence in stem cell science and applications to human health. Our vision is a world where stem cell science is encouraged, ethics are prioritized, and discovery improves understanding and advances human health. To join us, visit www.isscr.org/membership.